Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith, and hope. Discover more interviews at openhousecommunity.com.au.
With what seems to be an escalating frequency of acts of terror, it's hard not to be overwhelmed by the times that we're in. But what story is being written in the sweep of world history? Wayne Reynolds is an historian at the University of Newcastle. He's that rare type of person who can help us to stand back and look at history, seeing trends in the past that will help us to understand the present and perhaps point to outcomes in the future. I talked to Professor Reynolds about his view that the events of our day, individual acts of self-initiated terror, some of which stem from the claim to statehood of a certain type of Sunni Islam, were predicted back in the 1960s. I began, though, by asking about the Lindt Cafe siege and the coroner's finding. The coroner has found that that siege was an act of terror. But was Manharam Monis a terrorist?
Well, I don't think so. You've got an individual, sort of radicalised, wraps up acts of violence and terrorism, but with, as we now know, a long history of violence, and had been regarded by the police as, one, a nuisance, and secondly, a violent person. But identified as a terrorist, no. So almost impossible to know the extent to which someone self-radicalizes and desperately grasps this political justification for the action. But in every other respect, a particularly violent act, and over the years would be seen as a civil issue rather than a part of a global international plot by terrorists.
Not to diminish the importance of what happened, but it puts him in a different category, does it, from what we know, for instance, about the Manchester bomber?
That's right. Well, clearly you've got a smaller group there and links back to Libya, but also the profile of desperate people, refugees, that certainly don't turn their back on their homeland, and that's a state that's gone through considerable trauma in recent times. But until you drill down and ask questions about, well, okay, these are Libyans, all sorts of radical factions in Libya, to what extent have they directed their actions in Britain as part of some considered terrorist plot against the regime, as opposed to a local decision to take a violent act?
Now, why does this matter at all? Well, here's the thing. It matters because it determines the type of response you make, I presume.
Indeed. And that raises the whole question of what role do civilian authorities play in dealing with terrorism? So that and the Lindt Cafe raise in real concerns about, well, is it legitimate that the police turn out and handle this the way police do with a whole range of incidents? Now, how do you know that this is a military threat as opposed to a normal civil problem? Do you start taking people out very early in the siege because they're likely to be terrorists, or do you try to negotiate the situation to save lives? So it's all of these issues of who handles it and to what extent does that dictate the tactics that you're going to use.
And the tactic that they did choose was more of that domestic violence style of of negotiation, and quite a severe criticism from the coroner about the psychological advice they got.
That's exactly right. And so how many acts of violence are there? And in societies which are fragmented and alienated, and, well, where do you draw the line? There are all sorts of rebel groups and criminal groups around the world. Look at Mexico. There's a whole society fragmented with major gangs, major wars, but they're not terrorists per se. These people are fighting over drugs. So there are different parts of the world where people are motivated to do violence, but they don't necessarily have a political cover.
Do you think in some ways the coroner's report has not answered the question, but really begged other questions? I'm not sure that we're any clearer on what would happen next time.
No, that's exactly right. So that who's going to turn out? There are clearly issues like communications and whether they had information readily available, which in my mind was interesting because I thought with so much focus on global terrorist threats, there would have been a lot more expertise generally in the whole spectrum of military right through to civilian.
Oh, there are some serious questions there about infrastructure, even, you know, the most basic communications infrastructure. And then, as you say, access to good information.
That's right. And when you look at the resources we're putting into this, like terrorism is starting to become a very substantial part of our defence budget, trying to counter this. So choices are made about, well, how far do you elevate this plot and who's best placed to deal with it? And this raises interesting questions about self-radicalized terrorists, because you've got virtually the entire community in some way having a stake in that, whether they be school authorities or social workers, welfare workers. There are all sorts of people that would presumably be in a position to be part of a strategy to deal with local community violence, stroke, local acts of possible terrorism.
Now, we also know, of course, that the Australian authorities have certainly, and the police force particularly, has certainly spoiled or foiled many acts of what would genuinely be terrorism, have radicalised people with links back to an IS route who were not able to carry out, for example, attacks on Anzac Day ceremonies and so on.
That's right.
And so maybe we are good at that.
Well, that's the whole question of the nature of our intelligence operations and whether or not we are charting effectively the communication between various groups. And they come from right across the spectrum. When you go back to the days of the Lebanese Civil War, we had Maronite Christians, we had Druze militia, and heaven knows what else, trying to work out who was responsible for those acts of violence in Sydney, and they were quite real at the time. But no one was really suggesting that people were getting their orders in the Lebanese community from these factions, Marab Batoum or whatever, the Shiite militia in Lebanon, who were actually saying, well, okay, we've now imported this problem. But nevertheless, there were these networks, and there were contrivances in terms of criminal behaviour and, I guess, strokes of local terrorism. This to me becomes almost an impossible situation to discern. You can map it, you can have intelligence on it, you can track it, but acts of violence don't necessarily neatly fit into a political act as opposed to a civil act.
No. On Open House, our guest, Professor Wayne Reynolds, and an expert in global terrorism, and I was fascinated to hear you say before we began this interview that the events of individual acts of terror arising out of global economics and politics was predicted, in fact, by several defence writers and other academics in the United States many decades ago.
That's right.
What was the link there?
Well, if you wanted to trace it right back, it really developed a lot of attention in the mid-1960s, because the focus then was on Israel and the confrontation between Israel and a number of Arab states in the Middle East. And until Nasser, the leader of Egypt, and the 1967 war, there was a real sense that the Arabs could take Israel out through conventional military intervention. But in 67, there was a very famous war, which the Israelis won quite easily and quite conclusively. There was another conflict in 1973, which, if anything, underscored the military superiority of Israel. So what's come out of that period was the sense that, okay, we can't win in conventional terms. Now we're going to have to start looking at sort of unconventional or asymmetric responses. So you start to see a range of groups, many of them non-state actors, many of them associated with the Palestinian movement, groups like Black September, for example, call over Munich. And these groups start using violence, but orchestrated violence. No doubt that they were acting against the Israeli state and that they were organized, the Georgia Bash and the General Command, part of the Palestinian movement. They were conducting essentially an underground terrorist military strategy against Israel.
Yeah, so they look more like these.
Necessarily based on a state.
Right, and so they're individual actors acting for an ideology or an idea, and they look more like the acts of terror that we see today, and indeed more like guerrilla warfare than, say, World War II.
Battlefield warfare. Yeah, that's exactly right. And it gets a bit more complicated when you start to see it fragmented in the Middle East with individual acts on the West Bank, or in particularly in Israel itself, in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, where individual Palestinians, through the Intifada, they might be responding to appeals to rise up against Israel. But these are tactics of really desperate people, you know, blowing up a bus shelter, using knives, running over people with a truck. So they still have these anti-Jewish, or rather anti-Zionist attitudes. However, they don't have the means, they don't have the organisation. There's nothing like the symmetric threat.
No, and they're prepared to die for their cause, which means that it's hard to understand where to tackle that. Conventional warfare acts on the basis that if you overwhelm them with overwhelming military force, that's going to obviously defeat them. You're also trying to defeat their hearts and minds by saying that now we're afraid of the consequences of war. But if someone's not afraid, if they're prepared to die, well, that's very different.
Well, it is, but behind that act of desperation is a sense of utter despair. Yes. When you've had decades of being landless, you've lost your state, as you saw with Black September, they went off to Jordan and they got the boot from Jordan. Then they went into Lebanon and there were all sorts of problems associated with their camps there, and in a couple of cases there were massacres in those camps. So it's out of that that I think that you've got this sense of desperation, and you can multiply that out right across the Afro-Middle Eastern world. You've seen it played out in Somalia, for example, another tragic case of a stateless society that's tried in different ways to put together a unified government there, but it's fragmented, and a lot of terrorist violence has been associated with this state implosion, these failed states.
Well, in that context, how do we understand so-called Islamic State?
Well, I think there are a number of arguments about Islamic State. One of them is to go back and have a look at the problem of statehood for, the Arabs and certainly the Sunni Arabs after World War One.
Mm-hmm.
During World War One, the French and the British pretty well double-dealed on the rising against the Ottomans. Of course, the Turks ran the whole area, and these modern states have come out of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
But the Sunnis in the north were certainly missing out in terms of having a homeland, and they weren't alone. The Kurds and others didn't have a homeland either. But this claim to have a state, this is going to be our territory, and it's interesting that they were very effective in northern Iraq and northern Syria, so that's their sort of their heartland. So at one level, it's possible to see this in territorial historical terms.
Yeah.
They want, as they claim, a state. Our reaction has been to say, well, it's the so-called Islamic State, and to play up the role of the caliphate and Sharia law and all this sort of stuff. So, and the two have come together so that effectively their own brutal tactics and the role of sectarian violence has sort of undermined any legitimacy they might have had towards claiming a state. Nevertheless, there's that problem, and it's at the heart of a lot of the sectarian issues you're now seeing in Syria and Iraq. So that crescent, if you like, that Sunni crescent, is a key part of this problem.
Yep.
If they had a state and were given the legitimacy of a state in any other circumstance, in much the same way that the Palestinians have been saying, well, where's our state?
Mm.
A lot of these unresolved tensions go right back to World War One.
Oh, and funnily enough, in a slightly different way, it's the same concern, I suppose, of Kim Jong-un, who's got a state but wants to be able to defend it.
Well, that's right. And here again, you've got this asymmetric response.
Right.
The sorts of things that the Americans were talking about in the 1990s of these desperate states, dirt poor. In this case, a country that had no real nuclear infrastructure. It had an aging plutonium-based reactor, and it pulled out the old rods and said, OK, we've got enough for half a dozen type bombs. They tested. None of them is nearly as big as the Hiroshima blast. None of them worked properly. Haven't been able to get a rocket beyond a single-stage rocket, so not going to go very far. Deadly inaccurate. Defensively deployed, they're all in caves and using artillery to defend themselves against attacks. So there's this image of this global threat, but the reality is that you've got a very poor, almost dysfunctional state, and technologically nowhere near the sophistication of its adversaries.
Mm. Now, you see it in historical terms very clearly, and have explained it extremely well. Now, what do you say to those who say, well, you've got this overlay of a religion, which they say, at its heart, exists in order to fight against non-Islam, non-Islamic people?
Well, I'm an historian. Islam's been around a long time. There have been many shades and developments. You look at some of the dynasties like the Umayyads, you know, in terms of intellectual scholarship and great architecture, and these were highly civilized by any means. There have been Islamic states that had Christian guards, like the Ottomans themselves, had Janissaries, who were Christian soldiers who guarded them.
Right.
The translation of the works of Aristotle came from Islam. You can't just write off a religion and say they're incapable of civilized and even civil development. But there's no doubt that there have been groups that have been fundamentalists. There is Sharia law, and it's been applied pretty dramatically in a number of cases. But I've got to say, some of the acts of genocide and what have we've seen in the last century or so haven't come out of Islam. We're all capable of this sort of stuff.
Well, yes, and most of the worst acts were non-religious state actions. Stalin, for instance, takes the cake there.
Here's another example of a small state went through a traumatic period, and he turned on his own people. That was a genocidal act of the Khmer Rouge. Rouge against urban Cambodians. And, you know, these sort of acts of violence pile compared to what was done there.
Yes.
And he wasn't acting out of any religious fervour. This was a sense of what sort of society he wanted Cambodia to be.
Well, nevertheless, these the current era is very up close and personal, probably because it's so unpredictable and undoubtedly requires a very stern and appropriate response. But does history tell you the way in which we might see this play out into the future?
Well, I don't think, as with any conflict, it's going to be a military solution.
No.
You can put resources and surveillance and all sorts of things, and we live in the age of metadata, and we've never had such power to act on intelligence, although we often make mistakes. But at the end of the day, they've got to be big political solutions. And I think history shows things like the IRA, which went from being a fringe terrorist organisation to then being effectively taken over by Sinn Féin. They negotiated a role for the two islands. They then got into the EU, and bit by bit, there were alternatives. There was still frustration that they didn't have a united island, but violence wasn't the way to go.
Yes, or the ANC, which ends up running the country.
Well, the Palestinian Liberation Organization itself under Yasser Arafat.
Yep.
And a lot of Israelis said he was a terrorist, but at the end of the day, he was negotiating. And I think you've got the same problem with Hamas. You know, you might say, well, these are terrorists, but they were elected.
And but are you saying that one day we might see someone sitting down with an Islamic State leadership and negotiating a solution?
Well, sooner or later, and you're seeing this in Iraq, you've got the Kurds in the north, you've got the Sunnis in the north, you've got the Shiites in the south. Sooner or later, if you're going to have an Iraq, you're going to need these people around the same table.
Yes.
But sooner or later, somebody's going to have to negotiate these boundaries. Mm. And until you get genuine regional solutions, and the United Nations Chapter 8 was set up to do just that.
Mm.
You need the key regional forces around the table in the same way as in Korea. The Americans never went in there and said, well, we'll solve this situation bilaterally with North Korea. We'll have the six-party talks. We'll make sure that all of the local stakeholders have a role so that we can get some legitimacy under this thing. Now, you saw this with George H. Bush in the Middle East when he first went in to expel the Iraqis from Kuwait. He didn't go the path that his son took. He said, okay, let's do this through the United Nations. Let's make sure we have a regional force in place, we have limited goals, and then we'll start talking. Now, a lot of people were upset about the outcomes, but they were nowhere near as disastrous as when unilateral action was tried. So let's have a discussion about terrorism, but don't overreact to it. Don't slap on a terrorist label on every act of violence. Let's start dealing with the much broader social and civil issues that this raises.